Start with a laugh track. Okay, well, good to see everybody here. So, topic is effective discipline. Doesn't sound like the most exciting thing to talk about, but it is an important thing to talk about. And that's the way a lot of these things go. So, you have to remember when you're a teacher that the majority, maybe you don't all find it this way, the majority of anything really is a day-to-day grind, right? And so it's not all fun and games. It's not all exciting. That's in there for sure, right? And so, but it's just really much real life. And so we kind of have to talk about these things. So just curious, I always kind of like to know. I kind of know a bunch of you. But all of you that are teaching or have taught school, could you stand up? Just, and if you've taught for, so most of you are teachers. If you've taught over 5 years, remain standing. Over 7 years. Pick a number. Over 10 years. How many years have you taught?
Maybe 14.
Kind of lost track in there somewhere. Yeah, somewhere in there you just sort of, yeah, that's it. I was just asking another. How long have you been teaching? Well, let me see. I never taught long enough for that to be a problem. But good, so there's some real wisdom here, and I might be asking for some input here. So, first of all, what are we talking about? What are we talking about with effective discipline? Well, effective, here's a definition for effective. That's successful in producing a desired or intended result, right? So, in order to be effective, we have to be successful, right? To get to a desired result, an intended result. And then discipline. There's various definitions of discipline. And if you looked at the description, I don't know if they intend for the speakers to look at the descriptions or not, but there's really a couple different kinds of discipline we're talking about here. Right? So we'll get into that. One of them is the practice of training people to obey rules or a code of behavior using punishment to correct disobedience. That is a definition of discipline. Another discipline is definition is activity or experience that provides mental or physical training. And you think about, so now you know the Olympics are going on. What does it take to be that guy running those 400 meter hurdle, whatever they are, right? Well, it takes somebody with a lot different physique than me to start with. But beyond that, it is a lot of discipline from mental discipline, physical discipline, what you eat, when you, right? So we're talking about a little bit of that, right? But we'll get into. So, you know, what do you think of when you think of discipline? And what do you think of when you? And then that probably depends a little on upon your experiences. What do you think of when you think of a disciplined person? Right. So that's an important thing to think about. You know, in the In the state systems, right, with foster care and so on, you're taught, at least in Oregon, I suppose it's different everywhere, we were told, you know, discipline, they really didn't want to talk a whole lot about that, right? They say, you know, it is perfectly legal and okay for you to spank your own children, right? But the state's children, you're not going to do that, right? So there's, so, well, what can you do? Well, to get a little creative, right? So they talk about being really even timeouts, kind of on the edge of what you should be doing here, right? So really, time in is what you should be thinking about. And there's, while they're way, you know, overboard in a ditch, it's understandable for what they're talking about. But there's something to thinking about. Time in is basically taking the time to get involved, sit down, understand what's going on, not just get, you know, slap happy and throw someone in the corner, right? So that takes probably more discipline on our part, right? Now, there's a story, a couple stories, a couple side-by-side stories here of a couple great explorers. And I just say at the beginning here, I like statistics and I like numbers and I like, and sometimes when I get done, I find out somebody tells me like I got something wrong, right? It happens. So bear with me a bit. This is as closest I could get it. And history, when we're talking about history, none of us were there, right? We're going off of, and we're going to see through the story, there's things that happened over 100 years ago, claims that were made that nobody can prove, including the people that claimed them, could never prove, and some things are in dispute. These particular people we're going to be tracking, it's not real disputed what happened. These two men were trying to be the first human beings to the South Pole. Now, why you would want to do that? You know? But you think about this, early 1900s, people had pretty much made it around the world, but it was still a great time of exploration, and there's just not a lot of fame left. What are you going to do? What are you going to do to be a famous explorer? And there's just not a whole lot of options left. It's going to be the horrible, most miserable things with the destination, right? You can't just say, well, I made it to the middle of the Sahara, right? And I mean, so we have a destination here, and that's the South Pole. One had a ship full of about 65 men. He had three new power sledges, right? We're talking early 1900s here. 19 Siberian ponies, 13 sled dogs, and three sleds for those dogs. The expedition cost millions of dollars in today's funds, right? Not then. And it was backed by a lot of public contributions because there was a lot of excitement. There's a lot of national pride in these things, as well as a government grant. He was already pretty much a national hero because he was going to be the first one to do this. And he'd been to Antarctica before. He was with another explorer that tried, right? made it pretty far, figured out a route. Basically, he was an expert, gave lectures, he's traveled extensively, and he brought along experts from a lot of different fields and disciplines. Right, so he's been to Antarctica. He kind of knows what he's doing. Anybody recognize that person? Shackleton. Close. He said Shackleton. It wasn't Shackleton. He was, I believe, on the first. On the first trip that didn't make it.
Richard Bird?
Nope. Scott. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, what's his first name? I remember his name. Falcon Scott. Anyway, it was Scott. Yes. From England. There's another explorer. He was also on his second Antarctic expedition. And this man's claim to fame so far had been he was the first person to successfully navigate the entire Northwest Passage. Anybody know who that is? He's not that famous. Amundsen, or however you say it. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And he's from Norway. Mm-hmm. Right. So they're sort of dealing with the cold already, so might as well. Right? So and he had a little boat. He figured out how to get through the Northwest Passage. So he had you know, and after that little bit of fame, he was able to get a hold. Well, yeah, to get a hold of a boat called the Fram, and this is an ice navigating ship, and it was owned by the Norwegian government. And basically, though, there was even a more famous explorer from Norway that basically had first dibs on this thing, right? He basically managed this boat, even though it was the government's. And he took 19 men and only dogs and sleds for transport. And he was going to the North Pole, right? He had this plan. He's the first man to the North Pole. However, he changed his mind at the last minute because, reportedly, a couple Americans made it to the North Pole first. They have to remember, the North Pole is actually in the middle of the ocean, right? How do you make it to, you know, how do you, you can't sit there and plant a flag in the North Pole, right? I mean, you can, but it won't stay there. You're in, so sea ice, it's just a, it's a mess, right? But he's going to be the first one there. People have tried it. The South Pole is on land. There is a, the affinity, I mean, you can poke a flag in the ice over land instead of sea. So his funding dried up for his project because the public lost interest. I believe we have a little bit more on that here in a bit. And he gambled a bit here and mortgaged his house to be able to pull an expedition off still. And the people on his boat, his sponsors, the Norwegian government, the man who managed the boat, and the man he was racing against, still thought he was going to the North Pole. But he changed his mind. Just, that's just, you know. Right, so, who do you think's going to make this? Well, so that man's name is Roald Amundsen, and he was a Norwegian explorer. And as mentioned, so we're going to follow the stories now of these two men a bit. He was already acclaimed, as I said before, for making it through the Northwest Passage. And that basically, if I understand right, people tried it both ways. So from Europe, if you can see Europe, they would either come over here and try to go through, or they would come around, right? Because they're going to have to, they're not going to go through it twice, really, mm-hmm. right? And so, if I understand right, he took off and actually went up here and made it around Baffin Island and hugged the Canadian coastline. And made it through, and spent a lot of time with the Inuit up there on his way through. Right? He had aspirations to be the first to the North Pole, as was mentioned, which, but now there's no glory in it. Now, it's been disputed, and it was disputed kind of then, and even now, the people that claim to get to the North Pole basically would have had to pull off impossible feats. So nobody really knows if they made it. And there's no way to prove. There's not, like, there's no, you know, how do you prove that? And so, but here's the thing. He could not claim to be racing Scott. Right? Because Norway had just gained its independence. And they, the king was married to a British princess. And they relied on England, they wanted England to have their back, kind of protect them in the world. They just were just a few years old as an independent country. And so he would lose his boat, he would lose everything if he were going head to head with an English, with a British explorer. Right? So he didn't tell anybody. Well, maybe like two people, I think. Now, to go this time to the North Pole, he was in fact going to go from up here, hit Portugal, and down around the bottom of South America. And then up, right? And so, that was sort of handy. So they got to Portugal, and finally his conscience got the better of him, but they were already kind of a ways away. And he told his entire crew what he was up to. And he did get some pushback, but he talked them all into it. And so they all wrote letters to their families telling them what, you know. And he sent a message to Scott. And it was just a short, simple message. And the funny thing is, you'd think that that would be like, there'd be no dispute over what the message said. But I've read like two or three different direct quotes, you know. But basically, it was one sentence saying, I'm headed south. Right? Well, Scott knew he was headed south. Some people say that the telegram said Antarctica. But there was apparently still a question in Scott's mind, but he's pretty sure he knew what he was up to. Now, yeah, and the Panama Canal is not in, right? That's why they had to go the whole way around and then up. So that was at Portugal. Portugal is where he fessed up, right? But it was too late. From there, they went straight down to the Ross Ice Shelf, which, if you look at Antarctica there, you can see right here is the Ross Sea. Ross Ice Shelf, which would be, it's a little hard to put that into perspective over here, right? But I think it looks like it would be kind of over in here somewhere, right? And so that's where they headed. They headed on, you can't really see, but right where it says Ross Ice Shelf is a about where he landed. Now that was unexplored. That route to the South Pole was unexplored. Nobody had landed there and tried to go to the South Pole, right? And the reason that's significant is you see that mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually the beginning of land mass. The rest of it's an ice shelf, and it's a 10,000-foot mountain range you have to get through, right? And there is no known route through that section. So the other Scott had been here before, and he landed over towards this area somewhere, and there was a known route. They found a route through the mountains, but it was 60 miles longer. So Amundsen took a bit of a gamble, 60 miles closer to the South Pole, and figured, hey, it's just mountains, you know, just mountains in Antarctica. We can figure that out. So once they landed, they used all their dogs to sled stuff a couple miles, not really inland, but from where they could land. Right, so they're kind of in off the edge of the ice at least. And they had to get there in the summer, which means they're not going to the South Pole that summer. They're going to have to winter. So they set up kind of a permanent camp on the ice for the winter. Now a few people would stay on the ship, resupply, do all those things, you know. And you have to remember, these expeditions, only about five people would ever be the ones to do the final leg of the journey, right? That's not going to be the whole crew. The rest are support. So they spent the rest of the summer preparing for the winter, as well as the next summer when they're going to actually, you know, run for the South Pole. So when the next summer came, he's really nervous because Scott's ship actually came along to do some exploration after dropping them off on the other side of the Ross ice shelf and said, hey, here's, you know, and they actually had dinner together and bragged on each other's stand. And we've got these motor sledges, you know, and they work really, really good. Yeah. And they're just, in the meantime, they're really terrified of all these dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But they went back, and so they went back instead of exploring. They went and told Scott about the dogs. Now these people know about the motor sleds. And so Roald Amundsen is just terrified that Scott's just going to, you know, just take off. So he's trying to leave as fast as he can. And he took off too soon, a little bit. But they did make it back. They, you know, a little frostbitten and stuff. And over that, so there's a little insurrection. He actually banned a fellow explorer from coming with him to the South Pole over it. Mm-hmm. Kind of a discipline, I guess. It's not the point of this story. Exactly. But they did. They regrouped. They started out again. And they made pretty good time. And they really save their energy for later. They, you know, just a few hours a day, maybe 5 hours, and they would rest every hour across this ice shelf. Finally, they made it to land, which is the 10,000-foot mountain range, and it took them 3 days, but they did find a glacier. It was a steeper glacier than the other one that crossed the shelf. But they, and he, so he used, at that point, he had 42 dogs left with them,
mm-hmm.
right? And he used all 42 dogs to get up that ice shelf. And then they don't have use for 42 dogs anymore, right? So you got to remember, dogs eat a lot of food too, and dogs will eat other dogs, right? So they actually killed 24 dogs, and took the rest and ate them and fed them to the other dogs. It was just part of the calculation, you know. And it was tough. By that time they were kind of bonded with these dogs. And they got out of there as fast as they could. 18 remaining dogs, and they made a beeline for the South Pole. But he was just constantly fretting that Scott beat him there, right? They finally made it, and there was no sign of anybody, that anybody had ever been there. But we're at the South Pole, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you got the compass, and it's doing funny things, and he'd spent days trying to make sure that nobody could ever say he hadn't been to the South Pole. Once he was finally satisfied, he planted a flag, he left some supplies, and he left a letter for Scott and asked him to forward it to the Norwegian king. It's like, twist the knife a bit there. But he knew that the race wasn't over till the outside world knew. And nobody had radios with them. Which he was relieved about, because he was afraid even if he beat, Scott would have a... But he figured that out when the two ships met.
Mm-hmm.
So they raced back, made it to the ship, went to Tasmania, which you can see is not so crazy from if they're clear over on the west side of South America, and let the world know. He's on speaking tours and everything, right? Now, so we'll back up to Scott. Scott didn't know what Amundsen was up to, you know, for quite a while, until he received that vague message. And that made him really nervous. But he had decided from a previous expedition that dogs were not the thing. They just didn't work well, right? So take a few dogs, but dogs aren't. So ponies are going to be able to get us up the glacier, and then we'll just pull, man-sled this thing to the end. Okay. And there was some validity to his thought. He mainly focused on the ponies. And so he thought they could pull more weight, they could make it up the glacier better, and then he had this new invention, the gas-powered sledges. So he sailed to the other end of the Ross ice shelf, like I said. And it was further from the South Pole, but he calculated that because of his familiarity with that route, it's still an advantage. So he spent the remainder of the summer, making camp, preparing for the next summer's trip, and he was really nervous about Amundsen's dogs because he had reports. See, his guys got to see them in action going from the ship to the camp, and they were pretty speedy. So the plan was to take the ponies partway and then man-sled the rest of the way, like I said. However, if I understand right, a couple of ponies died on the way there in a storm. A couple ponies died in the blizzard. Some of them, they were camping. The ice shelf broke apart, and some of them fell into the water, and the killer whales got them. Right? And so they actually went around and killed the ponies so that the orcas wouldn't eat the ponies alive. You know, they were on the ice shelf. They could get around. But they had some ponies left. But these ponies would break through that top layer of snow. Mm-hmm. And he did have, the dogs they had, I don't know if they were hungry or what, but one time a pony fell through that top layer of snow and the dogs just pounced on it and just, you know, ripped it up. So when summer came, they couldn't leave as soon as they wanted to because the ponies couldn't handle the cold. The ponies they had left. Right? Mm-hmm. But they did. They finally got started, so they left after Amundsen by maybe a couple weeks. And so they plodded along, and they man-sledded most of the way, at least to some degree. And they did finally make it to the South Pole, only to find the Norwegian flag already there and a letter addressed to him. So they were tired, frustrated, disappointed. He had all sorts of neat British things to say about it. And on the way back, the cold weather, the winter weather, kind of settled in early, unfortunately. And on the way down that mountain range, so it was not just a picnic. Even Amundsen, going up there, getting through that mountain range, he and another person almost disappeared into the crevasses there, and just sort of got pulled out and made. Well, this one fellow on this expedition fell, got a concussion, and he ended up not making it. And as it came out of that, they should have been on the easy route back. They're on the ice shelf now. They could go. But they were all at this point malnourished, frostbitten, there's constant blizzards, 40 below temperatures, and one of them was a veteran, and he had a wound in his hip, and so that was just, he could barely go anymore. So he said, he was a 31, 32 year old, and I think he was kind of taking care of, Oates was his name, and he just said one night that he's going outside, he might be a while, and never came back. So they knew what he was doing. He walked out because he thought the rest of them might have a better chance of making it without him. So they went on for about another 2 weeks. Scott, and that's something Scott did very well, is he kept a really good diary, really good journal. About two more weeks, and 11 miles from the next depot, the blizzard socked them in for days. And all three of them died there. So so 65 men, five went in, you know, everybody else, you know, they were out doing whatever they were doing, right? But all five of the men that went to the South Pole did not make it out. Mm-hmm. Now, what went right and what went wrong? So here's a little bit of a comparison of discipline. So here's some things to think about. The goal. Mm-hmm. What's the goal? Well, both men were trying to make it to the South Pole. However, that was Amundsen's only goal. Now, we can't get too focused on one thing, right? But he had a goal. Scott was also trying to do a lot of scientific research while he was there. And his men, with their man sleds, on the way down the mountains, collected 35 pounds of rock to take out to study. And they did. They found the rocks with the dead men, and they did study them, and they learned a few things, right? But at what cost, right? And they did not need this 35 extra pounds, and they did not, you know, the amount of time they lost collecting them was fatal. But very, very likely, very possible. So the goal was really clear in Amundsen's mind. You get to the South Pole, you get back out, you let the world know, right? And it's not that the other thing Scott was doing is bad, but we're talking about the success of this venture. Second thing is the preparation. Right? So you have a goal, and you need to prepare. So here's some comparisons. Scott had an expert pick out his ponies, Siberian ponies. The only problem is he was an expert in dogs, not in ponies. And he did not pick good ponies. And this Oates that walked out, he also kept a diary. And he wrote that these are the most horrible ponies, that it's not going to work at all. And we don't have enough food for them. What is a pony going to eat in Antarctica? We'll get to that. Amundsen painstakingly searched out the best breed of dog in the world and had a dog expert pick him. And he got the dogs from Greenland. He decided those were the best ones. Now, Scott needed to bring a lot of fodder for the ponies, right? Because there's nothing in Antarctica for a pony to eat. A dog, on the other hand, can eat, you know, you can kill seals, penguins, other dogs, and they did all of those things. And Oates realized this, and he's like, we do not have enough food for the ponies. And so he personally bought at their last stop a bunch more feed and smuggled it on board just to hopefully get them by. Amundsen, as barbaric as it sounds, brought enough food for his dogs by bringing plenty of dogs. But it wasn't just that. They were of use to get up the glacier. And they did as much as, you know, they did as much as they could. They ate a lot of seals and penguins, like I mentioned. Scott brought the motor sledges. Whatever happened to those, right? But in picking his number two person on the trip, he picked somebody that was junior to the man that built the sledges. So he couldn't bring him along, right? Because of their whole system, like that, you know. And so he did not bring along the only person in the world that knew how to fix and these motor sledges. And in getting them off the ship, they dumped one in the ocean right away, so I understand it. And the other two just didn't. I mean, it's cold they broke down, they didn't work, and the only man that could do anything about it was thousands of miles away. They brought some dogs and sleds, but his men didn't know how to ski well, and that's why he thought dogs were bad. The expedition he was on before, the dogs are too fast and the men were too slow. And so they had to weight the dogs down so the men could keep up. And then you have to feed the dogs a lot, and you have grumpy dogs, and he didn't think dogs were a good idea. But he did catch on too late. And he built snowshoes for his ponies. But they didn't use them all the time. And even then, they only sort of worked, right? I mean, he thought about these things, but the implementation then was pretty bad. Amundsen just brought lots and lots of really good dogs. And his men were expert skiers, some of the best skiers in the world. And when it was too late, Scott wrote in his diary, "Skis are the thing. And here are my tiresome fellow countrymen too prejudiced to have prepared themselves for the event." So now we have the summer preparation, right? When they landed, what did they do? So Scott laid out depots along the route, right? So it's summer, we can take our dogs and we can go, whatever, ponies, whatever, and we're going to lay out food supplies along the way. We don't have to get the whole way. We can't get nearly to the South Pole. But they would go and they would set up a depot, come back, resupply, go set up another depot further, and that way, which was good. But he only set up enough, just enough, to make it. Missing one could be fatal. And in their fuel canisters that they left, he knew that in the summer the sun would shine and it would expand and it would leak out. They didn't do anything to mitigate that risk. And so the next summer when they came along, there was very little fuel in those canisters, and even melting ice for drinking water was a problem. So his men very probably were dehydrated. Some days they couldn't travel because the snow was blowing and they were afraid of missing their poorly marked depots. So they lost days that way. Amundsen laid out many more depots in one comparable strip. They didn't have the same route. It was 7 to 2. And by one estimation, he laid out 10 times more food for his individual men than Scott did. And he knew about the fuel problem as well, but he had the top soldered. And they actually found one of these 50 years later that was left out there, and it still is full fuel. And his depots were often well-marked and well-supplied. And Amundsen knew from his time with the Inuits, he didn't know why, but he knew to eat raw seal blubber, the vitamin C. Didn't know it was vitamin C, but his guys didn't get scurvy. Right? And they think probably Scott's did. Right? Now, while Scott's men were very malnourished on the way out, Amundsen's men actually gained weight on the expedition. Old lugs. Yeah. Now, clothing, Scott went ahead and did kind of a conventional wool thing. Amundsen knew from his time with Inuits to wear seal skin clothing and not too tight. Because they're working hard, they're skiing. They're actually, so gaining weight, they ate a lot of calories. Because they're actually skiing behind the dogs. And some of the way they could just hang on. But still, it's cold, you're burning a lot of calories. And it was loose enough and warm enough that, you know, it's the right combination. And then the winter preparation. So what do you do for a whole winter to keep from going insane, right? There's no light, it's pretty awful. Scott's men were men of learning, right? So they brought along volumes of books, you know, to read. And like thousands of cigars. And they played, you know, they actually, one of them adopted a penguin chick and stuff like that. Interesting stuff. But Amundsen's men had figured out in their laying out their depots, like, you know, there's a few inefficiencies we could work on here. And they took their sleds they pulled behind their dogs, and they peeled off up to 1/3 of the weight and kept the sled sound but much lighter. And that's the kind of thing they kept themselves occupied with for the winter. A lot of things like that in preparation. Now, both men were smart, and both men had provisions, enough provisions. And both men had big plans and ambitions, and both men had good intentions. But only one of them had actually the appropriate discipline in the planning for that particular task. Mm-hmm. If things would have been a little different, Scott may have made it, you know. But those few things, just those few tweaks, mm-hmm. he very likely would have made it without his dogs even, you know. But so what does this have to do with school? Because in the immediate physical sense, we're not really in this life and death race. Or even like this world famous race. But here are some things to consider. First thing is, discipline yourself. Right? And this is not an exhaustive list, but here are a few things. And some of you are probably teaching in your home community, some in a different community. But familiarize yourself with the school, your students, and even the curriculum. Take the time to do that. Another one that was mentioned this morning is keep yourself engaged with God. Have your personal devotions every day. One thing someone told me once that was really valuable, pray for each one of your students by name every day. And there's actually things about them to pray. You know, probably better than anybody else, except maybe their parents, what specific prayers to pray about the individual. And that takes time, you know, and discipline. And pray for love and wisdom, because sometimes, you know, we love them, but we don't like them, or whatever. You know. Get to more of that later. You engage yourself, keep yourself engaged in the community as much as you can. Show up at church. If you're in the youth, show up to youth things if you can, to events. Your children are watching and taking mental notes, for sure. And you have the privilege of living in a goldfish bowl. Now, the flip side is, so do all the parents. But maybe not quite to the extent, you know. Be ready for your day. Be ready for the day, each day. Have the devotions prepared. And that can be really simple. It can be short. Sometimes it's with the whole school. Sometimes you might be singing. It might be a student. But have something prepared, and sometimes have some actual thoughts prepared. Be ready to answer the questions that are going to come up. And this is especially thinking of upper grades, right? So I'm teaching algebra, for example. For me to be able to appropriately answer all the questions that were going to come up, I actually needed to do pretty much every lesson every day ahead of time. And I didn't do so good on some other things, you know. It's like, well, hang on while I research that, you know. Be concise. You should not be giving 30-minute lectures unless you have, like, one grade and all the time in the world. So whether you're scared of your voice or whether you're in love with your voice, have a well-thought-out, concise class prepared. But have a class prepared as much as you can. And be excited. And this does actually take some discipline for some of us. And know your goals. And be realistic about them, both in quality and quantity. Now, that's discipline yourself. The second thing here is discipline your class. That means have a discipline class. In Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life, the fifth one. Anybody know what the fifth one is?
Don't let your children do something that makes you dislike them.
Yeah, do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. And that's sort of profound. And it does apply to school teaching, not just parenting. You always, hopefully, will love your children, right? But sometimes, some moments of some days, you may not like them. And guess what? You're the teacher. Right? So don't let them do things. You can take anything too far. Don't let them do things that make you dislike them. So what about, for example, whispering? Right? What are your policies for whispering in the classroom? Teetotaler?
It's me.
I think I've learned a few things over the years. There have been years where I had a really big classroom and not so many students, or there's just a lot of square foot per person, and depending what they're doing, algebra, or if it was something at the computer where they're working on a yearbook, they could whisper. You know, I had to remind some of them that sewing circles is only on Thursday. But other than but and there were times when that worked. But guess what? There are years when that doesn't work. And so you really have that fair. You got to do that last year, not this year. Well, how's it? Yeah. Anyway. But so think about that. Will that cause you to dislike your students? It can get, you know, I mean, there's just a little buzz, and they're not, you know. And what about the other students have trouble, you know, paying attention or focusing? Start times. So personally, I think students should be in their desk at a certain time after the end of recess, you know, whatever. And buzzers help. That's great. Out times. Have a system that works, you know. Most systems can be exploited, right? So I've had teachers that put a little sign-up sheet in the back, you can get once a day, put your name. It's really easy to go up and put your name somewhere else with it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was this kind of a game. So don't set yourself up for that, please. Mm-hmm. Be reasonable, have a system that works, and then stick to it, right? I mean, within reason, obviously. And just general mayhem, you know? I mean, classroom size makes a difference, but generally if there's over one person up at a time, it just creates distractions and it's a problem. So, I've been in classrooms where rules and regulations have stifled the character of the class. Okay? Have your students respect, and that will come with you being disciplined. Mm-hmm. Partly. Make reasonable rules, and then go ahead and stick to them and enforce them if needed, and don't be afraid of your students. You should be their friend, but you need to be their friend in authority. And it is easier to become easier through the year than harder. However, there's the occasional time you have to get up in front of your students and say, you know what? What we've been doing isn't working. And so here's what we're going to do now. Right. Be reasonable about it. I have also been in classrooms where January 1, New Year's resolutions, and the entire everything changed. Right? That doesn't really build a whole lot of, you know. And so, start out where you need to start out. You do have to be able to adjust, right? But don't do maybe a major overhaul unless you really, really need. Is that a 3-minute bell? Yeah. Okay. Discipline your students then when necessary. Finally got to the better beating part. You know. Discipline should be meaningful, building, and free. Mm-hmm. Now, grades 8 through 12, they shouldn't be subject to belittling. However, sometimes there is just shame and wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. Right? So what are some good... I would like to hear what some good methods are, but we don't have time. In general, I would say it is nice to have your method of discipline in place ahead of time, like for a certain fraction. If you whisper, it's this, right? And that way it takes out that personal picking on this. It's just, it is what it is. It's a system. So in our school, in this age group, if somebody cheated, well, they get a free ride home with the school board chairman or their parent, right? And it's just, it is what it is. And... So, you know, it can be as simple as I have done this. If they're late from recess, you know, we had a 3-minute bell, and there was no reason generally to miss it. And so it was just, if for every minute they were late, it was 3 minutes with their head on the desk at recess, which isn't real popular, like with the 10th graders, you know. But they didn't then. It was just a system, and there was nothing personal about it. And it was what it was, you know. And one thing I did like, which I only did a couple years because it was a lot of work, took a bit of discipline on my part, was some sort of reward system, maybe a money system. And in the system, they could earn money for good grades, consistent performance, just with jobs, you know, like cleaning the restroom or, you know, whatever, keeping a clean desk, reading books, writing extra reports, all those things they could earn money for. They'd get fined for bad grades, whispering, just generally being bad. You know, I had a thing, you know, any amount of money for any infraction, you know. that was sort of up to me. But there were certain things that came with certain fines. And they could buy individual benefits. But, more importantly, and the bigger thing is they could buy group up to an extra field trip, right? And so that did create a bit of positive peer pressure, right? If a bunch of jabber is going to keep them from going on a field trip. So, in conclusion, I would say, discipline yourself first. Structure a disciplined classroom setting second. And then, when needed, when the students get outside of that discipline setting, then you will have to discipline the individual student. Be respectful and respectable. Be their friend, but not just the buddy, right? And be Christ to the world and especially your students. Thank you.